Day minus 7157. 1100. Jen's eyes open. Please be 2022. But she knows it isn't. Hip bones. An old phone. A really, really old bed. God, it's that low one that had the wooden sides. Air rushes out of her lungs. It isn't over. She sits up and rubs her eyes. Yes, her flat, her first flat, the one she bought when she'd just started work. She'd put down a £3,000 deposit, laughable in 2022. It has one bedroom. She gets up and follows the worn path in the tattered brown carpet into the hallway and then into the living room. It's been made boho by her soft furnishings. A chintzy curtain separates the sitting room from the kitchen. Purple cushions line a deep windowsill to disguise the damp. She gazes at it now in wonder. She'd forgotten almost all of this. Morning light filters in at the grimy windows. She checks her phone, but it doesn't have the date on it. She turns the television on, goes to the news, then to CFAX. Fucking hell, is this what they used to do to work out the date? It's March the 26th, 2003, 11 o'clock in the morning. It's 6 months earlier, and it's the day after she met Kelly for the first time. Today is the day of their first official date. She looks at her phone, though she can hardly use it. It can send texts, make calls, and she can play Snake on it. She navigates to SMS. Kelly's last message is right here, in the thread of conversation with a man listed in her contacts as hot painter, decorator, question mark. The man who she didn't know was going to become her husband. Cafe Taco, 5:30 p.m. question mark. From work, question mark. Kiss, kiss, he wrote. The text blocky and old-fashioned, the screen illuminated a neon calculator green. Her reply must be in a separate box, the messages unthreaded. Ancient. She goes to the sent items. Sure, she'd said, a studying casual language. She doesn't remember obsessing over it, but she's sure she will have. It's late. She used to binge drink and binge sleep. She feels hungover. She doesn't remember what she did the first night after she met Kelly, but she presumes it involved alcohol. She runs a finger over the kitchen counters, fake marble, and gazes at her possessions. Legal textbooks, but lots of paperbacks with high-heeled women on, too. Candles in jars and stuck in the tops of wine bottles. Two pairs of suit trousers balled up on the floor, pants and socks still visible in them. She takes a long shower, marvelling at the dirt between the tiles. Funny how we get used to things. She's sure she never gave it more than a passing thought when she lived here. Just put up with the mould on the windowsills, the constant noise outside, that she had to budget for every penny. When she's out, in her towel, she heads to her desktop computer. Something occurred to her in the hot, scented steam, and she wants to look it up now. She presses the spongy button on the front of the machine and waits for it to power up, shower water dripping from the end of her nose and onto her carpet as she sits. She watches the monitor spring to life and thinks. She had a best friend when she was a trainee called Allison. Jen wonders if this is why that alias tripped off her tongue so easily weeks ago. Allison worked at a nearby corporate firm. They used to meet every lunchtime. Buy a Pret lunch. Allison would slag off the law. Later, she cross-qualified as a company secretary, and Jen had stayed where she was, divorcing couples. And they had lost touch, the way you sometimes do when a friendship is born out of a common interest only. It's so strange to be here again, to know she could dial Allison's number now and catch up. How segmented life is. It splits so easily into friendships and addresses and life phases that feel endless but never, never last. Wearing suits, dragging a changing bag around, falling in love. She blinks as Windows XP loads in front of her. Jesus Christ, it looks like something from an ancient hacker movie. She finds Explorer with difficulty. Her internet is dial-up and she has to connect. Finally, she goes to ask Jeeves and types it in. Missing baby, Liverpool. And there it is. Eve Green, taken in the back of a stolen car a couple of months ago. So this is why the personal investigator couldn't find her. She was missing 20 years in the past. Kelly was involved in catching the ring that stole her, but they never found the baby. Kelly kept the poster. He must have shown Todd when he told him about it. That's why the burner phone, the poster and the badge ended up in Todd's room. And Kelly discussed it with Nicola, that she was never found. Jen's stomach rolls over. A lost baby. Lost for 20 years. She gazes out of the window at Liverpool, hazy in the low winter morning sun, trying to understand it. Her father is alive. Her best friend is Alison. In the future, she marries Kelly, the man she will have her first date with tonight, and will have a child with, named Todd. She thinks about the missing baby, Todd, Kelly, a crime ring made up of bad people and undercover people who are sometimes both, and more than all that, she thinks about how to stop it. The puzzle isn't yet complete. Clearly, it isn't over yet. She's still here in the deep past, still with things to do, to solve, and to understand. In need of some light relief, Jen heads to the mirror and drops her towel, unable to resist looking at her 24-year-old body. Damn, she thinks. 2 decades too late. She was a 10, but like everyone, she didn't appreciate it until it was too late. At 5:40, fashionably late, Kelly arrives in the cafe. Jen can tell, now that she has known him for 20 years, that he is nervous. He is wearing double denim, light and dark, effortlessly cool, the way he's always been, that hair turned up at the front. But his gaze is skittish, like a deer's, and he wipes his hand on his jeans before he comes over. She stands to greet him. Her body is so slim, it's so lightweight, like she's been underwater and just got out. She bumps into fewer things. There is just less of her, and she's so supple, so boundlessly energetic, the hangover burned off in minutes, cured with coffee and sunshine. Kelly leans to kiss her cheek. He smells of tree sap. That smell, that smell, that smell. She'd forgotten. An old aftershave, deodorant, laundry detergent, something. She'd forgotten his smell. And suddenly she is here, in 2003, in a cafe, with him, the man she falls in love with. She looks at him, her young eyes meeting his, and she finds she has to cover up a wave of tears. We do it, she wants to say. Once, in one universe, we make it all the way to 2022, still having sex, still having dates. We have a wonderful, funny, nerdy kid called Todd. But first, you lie to me. Kelly says nothing in greeting to her, typically him. She understands now the need to be guarded, because he is a liar. But his eyes flick up and down her body, and nevertheless her stomach rolls over. Coffee? Sure. She messes with the sugar packets on the table, pink sweetened lows. The menu contains coffee, tea, peppermint tea, and orange squash. Nothing like 2022's macchiatos. The front window is illuminated with fairy lights, even though it's late March. The rest is pretty mundane. Formica tables, linoleum floors, the smell of fried food and cigarettes, the sound of a till ringing up. People signing receipts for card payments. 2003 lacks the flair of 2022. There's nothing except the fairy lights that is there just because it's nice. No picture walls or hanging plants, just these tables and those blank walls and him. He's in the queue, weight on one hip, slim frame, his face inscrutable, an enigma. Sorry, he says, bringing over 2 old-fashioned cups and saucers. He sits down opposite her, and bold as that, her future husband knocks his knee against hers, as if by accident, but then lets it settle there. It has exactly the same effect on her the second time as the first. Even though she knows in precise detail what it's like to kiss him, to love him, to fuck him, to make a child with him, Kelly has never failed to turn her on. "So," he says to her, a sentence as loaded as a gun, "who is Jen?" His knee is warm against hers, his elegant hands plucking at the same sugar packet she was just messing with. He's always done this to her. She can't think clearly around him. She stares down at the table. He is undercover. His name isn't Kelly. Why does he never, ever tell her? Not in 20 years. That's what she can't figure out. The answer must be out there somewhere, beyond those fairy lights, but she can't yet find it. She wonders if, when she does, the time loop will end. And if not, what it'll take to stop it. "Not much to tell," she says, still looking at the street outside, at the 2003 world, thinking too about the glaring truth that she's been trying to ignore. Unless Jen and Kelly fall in love, Todd won't exist at all. "Who is Kelly?" she says back. She thinks out of nowhere of the way he bought that pumpkin for her, because she wanted it. The Belfast sink he got her. The lack of fucks he gives to the whole world in the future. Both inspirational and slightly dangerous. He excites her. They were good together. They are good together. But the foundation of it is this. Lies. A crumbling cliff edge. He lets his smile spread across his features as he looks at her, biting his bottom lip. Kelly is a pretty boring guy on a date with a pretty hot woman. Only pretty hot. Trying to keep my cool. Failing. He holds his hands up and laughs. True, I left my cool at the law firm door. The painting, then, it was a ruse. Something dark passes across his expression. No, but I don't give a fuck about decorating your dad's law firm anymore. How did you get into that, then? You know, I just never wanted to be of the establishment, he says. And Jen remembers this exact sentence, the effect it had on her, on of the establishment her. She'd found it thrilling. Now she's jaded by it, confused. She doesn't understand where Ryan ends and Kelly begins, whether the thing she fell in love with are the real him. Which area of law do you practice? I'm a trainee, so everything, dog's body stuff. Kelly nods just once. Photocopying? Photocopying, tea making, form filling. Another sip of his coffee, yet more eye contact. You like it? I like the people. I want to help people. His eyes catch the light at that. Me too, he says softly. Something seems to shift between them. I like that, he adds. You have much to do with the running of it, or... Hardly anything, Jen remembers being flattered by these questions, at his ability to sit and listen, unusual among young men, but she feels differently about it today. Kelly crosses his legs at the ankles, his knee leaving hers. She's cold with the absence of it, despite everything. That's good, he says quietly. She looks across at him. Sparks fly between them, like embers spitting out from a fire that only they can see. I never wanted the big job, big house, all that, he adds. She glances down at the table, smiling. It is such a Kelly thing to say. The attitude, the confidence, the edge. She finds herself tumbling. And for much of their marriage, they were poor, but happy. Tell me about the most interesting case you have on, he says. And she remembers this, too. She'd confided in him about some divorce or another. He'd listened for so long, genuinely interested, so she'd thought. Oh, I won't bore you with that. Okay, tell me where you want to be in 10 years. She looks at him, hypnotized by him. With you, she thinks simply, the old you. But hasn't he always God, what is she thinking? But hasn't he always been a good husband to her? Loyal, straight up, sexy, funny, attentive? He has. The knee is back again. He rolls up through his foot, moving his knee against hers. Jen's stomach is set on fire immediately, like a match struck with only the merest touch to the box. As the evening air gets blacker and blacker outside, the rain heavier, the cafe steamier, they talk about everything. The media. They briefly touch on Kelly's childhood. Only child, both parents dead, just me and my paintbrush. And where Jen lives. They talk about their favourite animals. His are otters. And if they believe in marriage. They talk about politics and religion and cats and dogs, and that he is a morning person and she a night owl. The best things happen at night, she says. The best thing is a 6 a.m. cup of coffee. I will not be taking any arguments. 6 o'clock is the middle of the night, so stay up then, with me. They get closer and closer as the table will allow them. She tells him she wants a fat cat called Henry VIII. Kelly, having no idea that they do get one, and he laughs so much he shakes the table. And then what's his heir called? Henry the Ninth? They talk about their favourite holidays. Cornwall for him, hates flying, and their death row meals. They both want a Chinese takeaway. Oh, well, he says around 10 o'clock. Just a rough upbringing, I guess. I want to give my kids better. Kids, hey? And there it is. A layer of Kelly that Jen knows to be true. I mean, yeah, he says. I don't know, just something about raising the next generation, isn't there? Teach them the stuff our parents didn't teach us. Well, I'm glad we've skipped the small talk. I like big talk. Did you come in yesterday just on the off chance of work? She asks, wanting to understand fully their origin story. He'd gone in to check with her dad, then come out only 5 minutes later. No, you know, he says, seeming to be wanting something from her, his expression expectant. Your dad and I have a mutual acquaintance, Joseph Jones. You might have met him. A bomb explodes somewhere, or that's how it feels, at least. Dad knew Joseph fucking Jones. The world seems to stop for Jen, for just a blink. No, I haven't, she says, almost a whisper. Dad deals with everyone. It's as though she's popped a balloon. Kelly's shoulders drop, perhaps in relief. He reaches for her hand. She lets him take it automatically, but her mind is whirring. Her father knew Joseph Jones, so... what? Her father is... is what? If Jen were a cartoon, a burst of question marks would appear above her head. Kelly's fingers are playing piano on her wrist. Shall we get out of here? He asks. They leave the cafe and stand outside in the March rain. The streets are washed with it, the spotlights of the high street reflected, the pavement a wet gold. He draws her to him, right outside the cafe, a hand on the small of her back, his lips right next to hers. This time, she doesn't kiss Kelly. She doesn't ask him back to hers, where they would talk all night on her bed. Instead, she makes her excuses. His brows lower in disappointment. He walks off down the street, a backwards wave behind his head, because he knows she will still be looking. Jen stands on the street alone, as she has 1,000 times since all this began. She draws her arms across her body, thinking of how to save her son, and thinking, too, about how nobody will save her. Nobody can. Not even her father. And especially not her husband. Ryan. He's in too deep. Ryan is standing in Jen's bedroom. It's the very early morning. She's sleeping, hair splayed across the pillow like a mermaid's. It's the second night in a row that he spent with her, hasn't been back to his bedsit since he met her at the cafe the day before yesterday. and he doesn't ever want to leave. That is the problem. Joseph has texted him today, asking how he got on. The fact that he went home with Jen will get back to Joseph. Ryan's mind spins, trying to work out what to do. Damage control, that's what he is focused on. You weren't joking when you said you were a lark, Jen mumbles, turning onto her side. She's naked. Her breasts roll together, and she covers them with the duvet. Sorry, he says, his voice hoarse-sounding. He's investigating her father. He's investigating her father. She thinks he is called Kelly. This can never, never work. Her eyes fly open and meet his. She props herself up in bed, then smiles at him, a slow, happy smile, like she can't believe he's there. Don't go, she says to him, bold as that across the room. She naked, he dressed. This can never, never work. Stay here with me, she folds back the corner of the duvet, inviting him back in. This has to work. I should go. Kelly, she says, and he loves the sound of that name on him, something old and something new, all at once. Life's too long for work. Life's too long. That's so clever. He puts his head in his hands, standing up like a madman. He loves her. He fucking loves her. Life's too long for work. She's right. She's so fucking right. His clothes are off, and he's back in the bed within a minute, with her. Do you like mornings yet? He says. I like them with you. Ryan's been up all night for the third night in a row. He's finally back home at his bedsit. He tore his body away from hers today at almost midnight, feigning tiredness, and came back here, where he has spent the entire night in his kitchen, sitting at the MDF table, making coffee after coffee after coffee. Jen is all he can think about. Jen, and what to do about Jen. Sleeping with the enemy, I see, Joseph texted him earlier. A crass, reductive text that removed the heart of it all, made it sound like only sex. Ryan stared at it before he replied, trying to figure out what to do. At 00:59 this morning, he made his decision. He'd forgotten that the clocks were going forwards. 0100 becomes 0200, and he has decided. Quit the police or lose her. In the end, he thought, in his shitty little bedsit, fake ID on the table, it wasn't a decision at all. He's waiting underneath the streetlight on the corner of Cross Street, stepping from foot to foot, telling himself he has no choice, none at all. He's freezing cold and his hands are shaking with too much adrenaline. Ryan is in love. Ryan no longer wants to change the world. Ryan wants to be with Jen. Jen, whose father is a facilitator of the organized crime group he's investigating. Jen, who thinks he's called Kelly, both parents dead, left school at age 16. Jen, whose eyes shine like she's been crying laughing. Jen, who said to him on their first date that she thought otters were dicks, that she wanted kids too, that she's only ever wanted to help people, whose body fits into his like it's always been there, like it's part of him. Jen, who says she eats too much, who kisses like she was invented only to kiss him. Her fucking father. Her father has been supplying Joseph Jones with a list of empty properties, which he has used to dispatch foot soldiers to steal the cars. He acted on conveyances of timeshare properties and kept a log of whose week was whose. That is how he knew when people would likely be away, leaving their first home vacant. Such a simple crime, born out of the day-to-day information lawyers have access to. And now, Ryan drags both hands through his hair, looking up at the sky. He wants to scream, but he can't. The man appears, an associate of an associate of an associate, hopefully far enough removed from Joseph, but who knows. The stranger is stocky, short, balding. "Bagged there," he says. Ryan might be back on Cross Street, but he's here for a different reason this time. He passes the stranger the bag of cash. The man counts the money, then gives him a wolfish smile, passes him a small, crumpled envelope from the back pocket of his jeans. Ryan takes it and leaves, fueled only by panic, no backwards glance. Ryan lets himself into the law firm when he knows Jen is out. Kenneth is there, in his office, and looks up, startled, when Kelly arrives. "I need to tell you something, and I need you to listen." Kenneth swallows just once. He looks like Jen, the fine bone structure. "It never leaves this room," Ryan says. "Okay." Kenneth's hands shake as he discards the contract he's reading, turning his attention fully to Ryan. Ryan leans over the desk to shake Kenneth's hand. His grasp is firm and dry. "I'm police. There is going to be an arrest of Joseph any day now. He forms part of a much wider organized crime ring, but he sits at the top of it, as I'm sure you know. No, I... If you tip him off, I will get you banged up." Ryan's never spoken like this before, but needs must. He has to do everything he can to extricate himself. Kenneth looks at him. "What do you want? Tell me how you came to be involved." "Kelly, I never... It started out so easy." "How?" Ryan folds his arms. "I couldn't pay the bills," Kenneth says quietly. "I literally couldn't. We were going to go under. I defended Joseph years ago on the civil element of a fraud case. He came in to settle his retainer, and he saw the overdue bills, said he could help. We cooked it up together. I'd act on the sale and purchase of timeshare properties for clients and keep the list of whose week was whose. Then I'd put in a calendar when all these various owners would be at the timeshare, and so not in their houses. It almost always worked. Most of them had two cars, so left one behind, usually the expensive, impractical sports car. Only occasionally did they skip their timeshare slot or give it to someone else, and if they did, we'd bail. I got 10% of the value of the car. Your actions resulted in a baby being stolen. I didn't know they'd try the next house too," he stutters. "You took the proceeds of crime happily. To pay the bills. Does Jen know?" "God no," Kenneth says, and Ryan thinks he's telling the truth. "She can never know," Ryan says. "She can never know about you." "No, agreed," Kenneth says crisply. "Or about me. I want to be with her." Kenneth blinks in surprise, and Ryan waits, saying nothing. He has a trump card. "If you comply, I'll get you off." "Okay," Kenneth whispers. "Okay, how do I..." "Get rid of your accounts. Burn them, drown them, whatever." Okay. "Any word, you're dead to me." "Okay. Good." "Before you go to be with my daughter," Kenneth says, holding his own trump card up, as clear as day, "tell me about you, the real you, and tell me why you want to be with her, because if you don't, I'm happy to fess up and go down for it. For her." "Just isn't for me," Ryan says in Leo's office. He's only seen it a handful of times, was always in his cupboard. Leo's office, as it turns out, is offensively large, room enough for two. "You know," he continues, "the lies, the deception. The police, generally. I hated response, and I hate this," he says. His voice cracks on the last word, because it isn't true at all. This is the biggest lie he has told since he lied to Jen about his name. His name and his career, so new, already feel bound together. His total, authentic self, kissed goodbye to. He wonders if he told Leo the truth, what he'd say. But he can't risk it. They wouldn't permit him to live as Kelly. It is their identity, created by them in order to embed Ryan in criminality. These fake identities are destroyed as soon as their purpose is up. To keep it would be to leave the police open to lawsuits, to criminal charges, to retribution from the criminals themselves. They'd make him come clean. The risk to himself and to Jen be damned. He has no choice. He's got to get out of the police. He's got to, before she finds out. She's become more important than him. That's love, Ryan supposes. He always knew he'd fall hard one day. He's that sort of person, isn't he? He just didn't think it would happen like this. He has to stay as Kelly. He looks at his mentor and friend and winces at the lies he's telling. I have to say I'm so disappointed, Leo says sincerely. I know, thank you, Ryan says. He hesitates just for a second, wondering if he's doing the right thing. But it's the police, or it's her. His resolve crystallizes like hardened clay. There is no contest. Right, well, you know, Leo pauses, and Ryan thinks he's going to elaborate, but maybe he changes his mind because he just looks at him and says, yeah, I get it. Effective immediately. It has to be with UC work. I know. I'm sorry it didn't work out, Ryan. Me too. Any idea what you'll go and do? Ryan stares at Leo's immaculate desk. The question is enough to crack his features with an ironic smile. He guesses he will have to go and be a painter-decorator, like he said he is. Nah, I'll figure it out, I guess. Will you still come to give your evidence? Your work was invaluable. Ryan glances at Leo. He can feel his gaze is cold. I know, Leo says. I know we didn't find Eve. Yeah, Ryan says. That cuts him up. Maybe if he hadn't met Jen, maybe it wouldn't have happened like this. Maybe he could have stayed longer. But he wouldn't choose it. Not now he's met her. He's a goner forever. Happily so. The daughter at the law firm, he says quickly, I'm pretty sure she doesn't know. And the dad, honestly, he's just a small-town idiot. Is he? Concentrate on Joseph. Not even sure the dad knew the significance of passing the addresses, Ryan lies. Your evidence will be useful. I'll do it if you don't go after the dad, just Joseph, the other foot soldiers. I'll talk to those on the top landing, Leo says slowly, seeming to understand that Ryan is negotiating, even if he doesn't know why. Okay. One problem solved. He might get away with this. All he needs to do now is become somebody else. But hey, we'll get the main man, you know? He'll go down for 20. Yeah, well, Ryan says sadly, standing there in front of Leo's desk. Doesn't seem worth it somehow. Not without the baby. I get that, Leo says amiably. This must happen all the time, especially in undercover. He holds his hand out and Ryan slaps the legend into his palm, the police-issued passport and driving license in Kelly's name. All gone. Yeah, you know, Rye, I don't think I'd do it if I had my chance again, Leo says, taking the documents. This stops Ryan. Really? He says. Yeah, I mean, it's no way to live. What's the difference, really, between pretending to be a criminal and being one? Ryan doesn't answer the rhetorical question, just looks at Leo, who shows him the door after a few seconds. Adieu, Leo says softly as he leaves. Ryan always wanted to change the world, but it doesn't matter anymore. Maybe he's bitter, but suddenly Ryan feels chewed up by a system he hadn't even thought twice about getting involved with. From here on, Ryan vows, he will not give a fuck what anyone thinks of him. Society, employers, anyone. He won't let anybody get to know him. He will only let one person in. Her. He goes to his cupboard to say goodbye to it. He leaves most things here, at the station. The only things he takes are the talismans he can't bear to part with, his badge and the missing person poster with the baby on it. They are too precious to lose. He'll keep them with him forever, whoever he is. As he leaves, he thinks of the jiffy bag sitting underneath the passenger seat of his car, containing a new fake ID purchased from a criminal last night. He has no choice but to become Kelly. Anything else would tip people off. Joseph knows he likes Jen. He can't be with her but become somebody else. There is no way back. He stepped into an identity as Kelly, petty career criminal, and now he's got to live it. Kelly Brotherhood. That's the surname he chose when he elected to go undercover as Kelly, the criminal. Brotherhood. To honour the real Kelly. He thinks about what Leo said about the heads of organised crime gangs, how they stay under the radar. No travel, don't pay tax. So he won't go abroad, won't get through airport scanners, shouldn't ever get pulled over. But he can live, love, get married. He tells his mother through tears. Then he tells a couple of Joseph's associates that he'll call them up when he's back in the game, but he's staying under the radar for a while since Joseph's arrest. After all this, he gets a tattoo. His skin scratches and burns hot as the needle scars his skin forever. His wrist is marred, branded with his decision, made in haste in the middle of the night as the clocks went forward, but which he knows he will never regret. The date he fell in love with her, and the date he became himself. Day minus 7,158. 1,200. It's the day Jen meets Kelly. She's always known this date, when the handsome stranger walked into the law firm. But today, sitting at her desk, working on the enormous 2003 desktop computer, she waits to meet him for the first time. She has that March feeling, fun in the sun and laughing with him. She will always feel that way, whatever happens, whoever he is, whatever his reasons for his betrayal, his secrets, his lies. She never liked working in the reception area of her father's law firm. People always thought she was a secretary. But today, she likes the vantage point, the plate glass windows, the bleak March High Street outside, the silence of the reception, ancient and sweeping, and hers. Jen, her father says, walking into the foyer. She turns her gaze to him. He's 45, strapping, big, happy, healthy. She can't bear it. His youth and his betrayal, his connection to Joseph. When she visited him in 2021, had the garlic bread with him, he must have known. He must have known what Kelly had been up to, surely. We need to file the Part 8 by 4 o'clock, he says. Sure, sure, she says, no idea what he's talking about. As she's pretending to type, clicking around on the fucking enormous and antiquated computer, she notices movement outside. And there he is. It's Kelly, trying to look inconspicuous, but because she knows him, she sees him. He sticks out. And he's watching her, trying to look like he isn't, in a hoodie, the same denim jacket he wears tomorrow on their date. That hair. Jen, her father says, Part 8? But Kelly's coming in, a head poked around the propped open door. A March gust whooshes in. They never liked the door closed, didn't want to deter patrons. All right, Kelly says, her husband who doesn't yet know her name, whose motivations she doesn't yet know. Just wondering if you want any painting and decorating done. They're walking back from the pub lunch, the shared umbrella. Kelly has brushed his shoulder against hers several times. We're so late, she laughs. I'm a bad influence. It's quiet in the reception, only the noise of her computer whirring, and in the depths of the building, her father on the phone. Tea? She says to Kelly. He blinks, not expecting it, but nods anyway. Sure. She disappears into the tiny kitchen off the reception, but this time she waits, watching him. And that's when he does it. The thing she now knows he will do, but that breaks her heart regardless. He slowly begins to root around on her desk. He's good. Head bowed, hands barely moving as his fingers sift gently. Unless you were looking at his hands, you'd never know. Jen allows it to continue, just watching, taking her time with the tea. He inches a drawer open and... God. All these years ago, he was doing just this. Her heart is pounding. He pulls a piece of paper out of her drawer, then slides it back in again after he's looked at it. Her father emerges from his office just as Jen thinks she's been far too long making the teas. He nods to Kelly, and Jen stops herself joining them, just listens. "Thanks for the list earlier," Kelly says in a low voice to her father. "I wondered about this timeshare, this number here. Is that an 8 or a 6? "Ah," her father says, perfectly politely, unsurprised. He pats his suit uselessly, looking for his glasses. "A 6. "Okay, thanks," Kelly says. He is scanning the piece of paper. Jen swallows. The timeshare conveyances her father pretended not to remember. Her father facilitating organized crime. Her husband investigating. It was her father who was bad. The world seems to tilt and spin. Her father, a crooked lawyer. And it was Kelly who was investigating him. All those questions on their first date, his intensity, part of their origin story, the way they fell in love. Only it wasn't. What was that about? Jen has been to run some documents over to another law firm to cool down, to think things through, and now she's back and ready to ask her father while she can. Nothing. No, what was on that paper you looked at? Was it addresses? Her father avoids her gaze. Of unoccupied houses, she prompts. It's a small side project. His eyes shift to the side. But he's no idiot. He can tell what's coming, and he walks over to the window to close the blind, then brushes past her to close the door. Of what? Selling data? To criminals? Don't lie, she says to him. I'll ask Kelly if you won't tell me. Her father turns away from inspecting a filing cabinet and looks at her. He starts to say, I doubt Kelly would tell you, he says eventually. Jen sits down in the chair in the corner of the room. We couldn't make rent, her father stammers. I thought it was just information, like people who sell whiplash claims. But this isn't whiplash claims. No, I thought you were straight as they come.
I was.
But until...
Money, Jen.
The force of this sentence makes him spin just slightly on the chair.
It was a bad decision. But by the time you're working with someone like that, you can't extricate yourself.
I regret it every day.
So you should.
Her father's eyes flick towards her. This conversation is excruciating for him. Perhaps the strangest thing about travelling back through the past is the changes people themselves undergo. Kelly going from dark in 2022 to lightness and naivety in 2003, her father from openness to repression. Do you remember before you started out here when we couldn't meet the rent? We organised a longer payment window. You drafted the deed while you were at uni. Her first ever contract. Of course she remembers.
Yeah.
Well, after that, an old client came in and... Jen, he made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Passing those names and addresses kept us afloat for years. It paid for your LPC. It's paying for your training.
People being robbed?
How did you find out?
That doesn't matter, she says.
She almost wishes she hadn't found this out, she thinks, looking at her father, thinking about how she can never unknow it. But finding out that Kelly discovered this dark secret right in the centre of her family and never told her. It is a kindness. Kelly kept his identity, his transformation, secret from her. Because he loves her. And because he walked into the law firm one day in 2003, fell head over heels in love with her, and didn't want to look back.
Day minus 7,230, 0800. Jen is back in the flat when she wakes. She blinks, looking at the sash window and the purple cushions below it. She flings an arm across her eyes. She's here. She rolls over in her single bed, still in the past. He did it because he loved her. He has been lying to her for 20 years. What else was he supposed to do? He isn't who he says he is. He gave up everything for her. He never told her her father was bent. Why is she here? She pads out of her bedroom and into her kitchenette. It's full of early morning January sun. She hasn't yet met Kelly. His number isn't yet in her phone. He's undercover, investigating her father. That's why he never tells her. That's why he warns her in the future about looking into it. That is why Joseph comes to the law firm to find Kelly, to start things up again, and to notice which of his old associates may not be who they said. This is why Kelly says in 2022 that she is in danger, that she should stop looking. Joseph assumed she knew what her father was doing. He said as much in the prison when they met. She goes to the sash window that overlooks the crowded streets, already full of commuters in suits. Her husband-to-be is out there somewhere, working as a police officer, yet to meet her. She turns away from the sunlight. January the 12th, the date from the news story she saw after her shower. Today is the day Eve goes missing. Tonight is the night she is stolen. Jen takes the bus to Merseyside Police in Birkenhead. It's so like Crosby Police Station from the outside, a 60s building. A revolving door lets her into a bright foyer. Bigger than Crosby, but still as tired, the same kind of chairs bolted to each other. She thinks about how they sat in them on that first night, all those weeks ago, but years into the future, Kelly vibrating with fury. She supposes it is easy to disappear. Quit the police, go travelling in a camper van with the woman you love, resettle out of Liverpool, never travel, get married using a fake passport that nobody ever checks. Thousands of people must do it for reasons both more and less honourable than Kelly's. Jen has never once in Crosby bumped into somebody she grew up with. She wonders if Kelly had any near misses. The world's a big place. A receptionist with thin, plucked eyebrows and her waterline pencilled in the way that everybody did in 2003 types at a boxy computer. I need to speak to a police officer, Jen says. He will go by the name of Ryan or Kelly. Why? I have a tip-off about the crime ring operation that he is working undercover on, Jen says. As she says it, a man pushes the door open. He's old, maybe 50, and has feathering grey hair at his temples. His face arranges itself into an expression of surprise. Kelly, he says to her. I need to speak to Kelly. I know he's undercover. You better come in, he says. He reaches to shake her hand. I'm Leo. Kelly is sitting opposite Jen in an interviewing suite, and he doesn't know who she is. It's crazy, but it's true. To him, they have never met. Look, Jen is explaining patiently. I can't say how I know, but the house they intend to burgle tonight, they intend to take two cars. She dutifully gives the address of Eve Green, taken from the news story, which Leo and Kelly write down. It's the same address, only one digit different from the one on her father's piece of paper. 125 Greenwood Avenue. Thanks, Kelly says professionally to her. His blue eyes linger on hers. No intel at all on where it came from? Jen's gaze meets his. Sorry, can't say. Sure, okay. Well, he says, dismissing her as though she is a stranger, we will be sure to check it out. A fixed, careful smile. She looks at him, wondering where the join is between him, this Ryan, and her, Kelly. Whether he became the latter or always was deep inside.
Suddenly, there in the police station, looking at this man that she has loved for 20 years, she wonders if it matters. Does anyone care how or why we are forged into who we are? Dark, guarded, funny, whatever? Or does it only matter that we are?
You will look into it.
Yeah, of course, he says lightly. Life's too long not to follow a lead. Jen waits on the road where it all happens that evening. She is sitting in an old banger of a car, wondering how come her father could do it, supply information to criminals, keep it from her, let her marry somebody undercover. It begins to rain, spring drops that fall irregularly on the roof of her car. She thinks, too, of what her father said the night he died, that Kelly was straight up. Why would he say that if he didn't believe Kelly to be good? Perhaps he knew. Perhaps Kelly told him. Something pops into her head as if from nowhere, the sign she saw at the NEC but didn't realize the significance of, abdominal aortic scanning. You could scan for the illness that killed her father. She wonders if that technology exists yet. If it does, she could do that. Call him now, tell him to get a scan, save more than one life tonight. She rests her elbow on the window and her face in her palm. She knows somewhere deep inside her that it isn't the right thing to do. She thinks of him asking her to make that garlic bread, content as anything. She thinks too of her mother, long gone before him. Perhaps it was his time to go. You can't save everyone. You just can't. She must have woken up on the day he died so that she would go and speak to him and learn something about the timeshares. That must be what it was for. Nothing else, but something still feels unfinished about it to Jen. The police have 123 Greenwood Avenue surrounded with unmarked cars. Eventually, around 11:30, they arrive. Two teenagers, just boys really, barely Todd's age. They get out of the car wearing all black, their bodies like spiders, and she watches them go in. She knows it'll happen, but is still awed when it does, that she, 43-year-old Jen, is still here, in a much younger Jen's body, watching the things happen that she knew would, the things she's worked out, despite never believing that she could, that she was capable of it. She watches them fish keys out of the letterbox. She knows things are coming to a close. She knows that this is the last day, however it will end. Like clockwork, a tired-looking woman emerges out of the house next door to 125, carrying a baby. She lowers the baby, crying, into a car seat, then stops, patting her pockets. She hesitates, looking at the quiet street, not seeing the car parked wonkily, not seeing the careful letterbox crime happening next door, the two boys dressed in black, camouflaged in the shadows of the house. At that moment, blue, an explosion of light so blue it's though the saturation is turned up, police everywhere, emerging from cars and shrubs and behind buildings, arresting the teenagers. She hears somebody read the caution out. She thinks of Kelly, absent for his own protection. She hasn't yet done anything that will require undercover testimony. He hasn't yet become Witness B, and everyone he will become after that. He hasn't yet met Jen as he knows her. The woman with the baby hasn't left her driveway, has just watched it all play out, holding Eve, with no idea of the bullet she's just dodged, there but for the... We only think of the bad things that happen, rather than those that, through fortune, pass us by. Jen closes her eyes, leans her head on the steering wheel and wants to sleep. She's almost ready. There's a deep knowledge sitting underneath everything, just like Andy said there would be. She'd lived her life once and missed it all, but her wise mind, her subconscious, it knew things. She's almost ready. Almost 1 o'clock in the morning and the police pull back up at Merseyside Station, where Jen is waiting, and so too is Kelly, just as Jen hoped. The moon is out, the sky high and clear, and Jen is almost gone. She knows it.
Kelly and Leo get out of an unmarked car. Leo goes immediately to his own car, but Kelly loiters. He walks slowly towards the station, his breath puffing out into the cold winter air. He pulls a mobile phone out, presumably to call a taxi home. She gets out of her car before he can dial. They only met once, earlier today, and uncertainty crosses his features, confusion blended with amusement. He is all Todd. "Hi, we met earlier," Jen says, hurrying over to her husband of 20 years. "All right," Kelly says, his frown deepening. "You okay?" "Yes," she says breathlessly. She's so far back now, an arrow aimed at the future, the slightest tweak, and she will miss. "I just wanted to know, the burglars, my tip-off, you got them?" "We did," he says carefully. He puts his phone back in his pocket, but turns his slim body away from her. The remoteness stops her in her tracks. There in the January drizzle, almost identical to the October mist, he doesn't know, she thinks, looking at him. This man she's loved and laughed with, got pregnant by, said vows to, shared a bed with. He doesn't know. He doesn't know her. She is seeing wary Kelly, the way he greets strangers. He has nothing to be wary of, now, in the past. But he still is. He is still him. She was right. He is still himself, the man she loves. "I'm so glad you got them." Curiosity gets the better of him. "How did you know?" "I can never reveal my sources," she says, the exact kind of banter he likes. His face eases into a grin. "You asked for me. You said you wanted to speak to Ryan or Kelly." "Yeah, I know. Nobody is supposed to know the connection between those two names. I mean, I barely knew that." Jen shrugs, holding her hands out by their sides. "Like I said, no sources." She's getting wet out here in the cold mizzle. "Ha, well, you know, we intervened so early. The main guy got away, we think. Our arrest of his foot soldiers tipped him off." Joseph. Joseph got away. Jen shivers with something more than the cold. Shouldn't she be wary of one thing? Unintended consequences. But didn't she do the right thing whenever she could? She didn't play the lottery. She didn't even save her father, not this time, though she had the opportunity. She let those things go. She draws her coat further around herself and moves closer to Kelly, hoping it'll be okay. "I think you did the right thing," she says softly, sadly, thinking of baby Eve, thinking about how we never see the near misses that slide past us, just missing us, arrows just grazing our skin. He hasn't called the taxi yet. His gaze lights on hers. And she knows, she knows, she knows that look. He raises an eyebrow, and then he says it, the sentence which changes everything. "I know this is a fucking cliche, but do I know you? From before today?" Jen can't help but laugh. "Not yet," she says, the banter with her husband flowing as easily as ever. She meets his eyes in the car park. He fell in love with her so deeply that he gave up his life for her, his name, his mother, his identity. She doesn't think he has been pretending all of their marriage. She thinks he was trying not to. "I'm Ryan, anyway. You?" "I'm Jen." And this is the moment Jen knows. She's ready. She closes her eyes as if falling asleep. And she's gone. And everything that has been is wiped, just as she suspected. Day 0. 0159 becomes 0100. Jen Hiles is on the landing. The pumpkin is there. Everything is there. On her skin, she can still feel the phantom mist of the January night, still feel her husband's eyes on hers. Her husband emerges from the bedroom. "All right," he says. "Tell me about the day we met," she says to him, stepping into his warm embrace. "Huh?" he says sleepily.
Tell me, she says with all the urgency of somebody with everything on the line. You came into the station? Jen gapes in disbelief. She's done it. She's lived it. These whole 20 years with him, with Ryan. Am I a lawyer? She asks him. Yeah. I need to sleep. I'm on shift tomorrow. He's a policeman. Jen closes her eyes in pleasure. He will be happier, no longer so unfulfilled, no longer found wanting. It's so fucking late, he moans, but still him. Is my dad alive? She says. What's happened to you? Please, just tell me. No, he says, and that's when Jen understands it. The paper cut, saving her father. Neither of them lasted. Andy was right. Events played through from that rainy day in January, almost 20 years ago, erasing all the other changes she made along the way. Changes she only made because they gave her the information to go back to the right place, the right time, and solve it. Hello? Todd calls. Something lifts in Jen's heart like a sunrise, dawn breaking over their lives. It's Todd. He's home. Home. Calling up the stairs, not walking along the street, knife in hand. You're still up, Todd calls. You're in the window like a fucking rude picture. Kelly laughs loudly. Hey, Ryan, Jen says. Hmm, he says, as though it's nothing at all. But to her, his name confirms everything. Jen stares at him. Same navy eyes, same slim frame. A tattoo that says only, Jen. So Joseph didn't get caught, but the baby never got stolen, either. Jen reflects on this, just for a second, in the picture window. Well, you win some, you lose some. Criminals will always trade in drugs, in arms, in information. They will always steal and lie. You can't catch everyone, but you can save the innocent. Did 20 years in prison teach Joseph anything anyway? She looks at her husband and at her son coming up the stairs two at a time. Isn't it a price worth paying? Something niggles in the back of her mind, something about how she will account for this, this strange period of her life spent reliving it. All right, Todd says, interrupting her thoughts. Where have you been? Out with Cleo? Who's Cleo? Todd says, staring down at his phone. Of course. Joseph never comes to find Kelly, so Todd never meets Cleo. Jen stares at her son. She has denied him his first love. Is that a price worth paying too? I had a dream you met somebody called Cleo, she says, wanting to be sure. Eve wouldn't like that, would she? Todd says. Eve? Jen says sharply. Who? My, Todd's eyes slide to Kelly, who shrugs. Girlfriend? What's her surname? Green? The baby. The stolen baby that was never stolen. Jen is standing at the edge of a hurricane, feeling just the breeze of it beginning to waft her hairline. Can I see a photo? Todd looks at her like she is a total idiot and flicks through his camera roll on his phone. And there she is. It's Cleo. It's fucking Cleo. Cleo was the stolen baby. No wonder she felt recognition when she saw the photo of the baby. Jen reaches in a daze to hold his phone in her grasp. He lets her do it easily. No secrecy here, not really. Wow, Jen says, zooming in on her features. Never seen a woman before, Todd remarks. Let me look in peace, Jen says, working it through. So, now, baby Eve was never stolen. Jen prevented it. She stayed with her mother as Eve Green. Jen stopped the meeting in one way, but look, they met in another. She fell in love with her son in 2022 the same way she did as Cleo, when she was stolen and sent to live with a relative of Joseph's. Fate. Jen looks up at her husband and at her son. Cleo, Ryan, Eve, Kelly.
people whose names have changed, but whose love has endured despite that. Jen extends an arm to him, and Todd steps into their embrace, and they stand there in the picture window, just the three of them. Jen's breaths slow. She goes downstairs after a few minutes, just to check, just to look, her hand on the doorknob. A strange feeling descends around her like a fine mist. Déjà vu. What was that? She shakes her head. Stolen babies and gangs? She blinks and it's gone. How strange. She never gets déjà vu. And on such a normal evening, too. Day plus one. Jen wakes up. It's the 30th of October, and for whatever reason, she isn't sure, she feels as though she has her entire life ahead of her. All right, Todd says to her on the landing as she pulls a dressing gown around her. You okay? Sure, Jen says. She has a headache, but that's about it. She can smell cooking downstairs. Ryan must have started breakfast. You said some weird shit last night. Thought I had a girlfriend called Cleo. Who's Cleo? Jen says. Epilogue. Day minus one. The unintended consequence. For the first few minutes after she wakes up, Pauline has forgotten. And then she remembers. Dread descends, as she does, and she shoots out of bed like a firework. Connor. She'd known this was going to happen for months. He's been secretive, rude, sullen. She's been waiting up for him all hours. There's been a series of escalating behaviours, and now this. It began with the déjà vu last night, and then, right after that, Connor was arrested. The police said he'd committed all sorts of offences, drugs, thefts, the lot. He's been involved recently, over the past few years, with somebody called Joseph. He's supposed to have the rest of his life in front of him, and here he is, ruining it. She needs to call a solicitor. She needs to fix it. She needs to do so many things. She needs to get to the bottom of why he did this. She heads out onto the landing, ready to fire up the computer and find a solicitor. But there he is, her boy, on the landing. She says to him, did they let you go? Who? The police. What police? He says with a laugh. And that's when Pauline sees it. The date, flashing up on BBC News, blaring from inside his room. It's October the 30th. Wasn't yesterday the 30th? She's sure of it. Hysterical strength. Hysterical strength is a display of extreme strength by humans beyond what is believed to be normal, usually occurring in life or death situations, particularly involving mothers. Anecdotal reports are of women lifting cars to rescue newborn babies, sometimes creating a huge force field of energy. Indeed, more supernatural reports have also been noted, such as time loops, though none has been proven to date. Sufferers often report déjà vu alongside episodes of hysterical strength.
We hope you have enjoyed this Penguin audio production of Wrong Place, Wrong Time by Gillian McAllister, read by Leslie Sharp. It was produced by Anne Larson and the post-production was by Wardour Studios. Copyright in recording, Penguin Audio, 2022. Text copyright, 2022. All rights reserved. The moral rights of the author have been asserted. For more Penguin Audio productions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Thanks for listening.